Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, we'll bring you the stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, was South Africa's Trump meeting a trade breakthrough or just theatre? A top mining commentator breaks down the sectoral law overhaul and what it really means. Tony Leon on the political players who shaped our democracy, part two of our discussion on his new book on the government of national unity, and why smart companies are ditching the hard sell for useful information. It's Monday, the 26th of May. As South Africa continues to navigate a turbulent global trade environment, there are still questions remaining over the future of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, and the country's broader positioning as far as international trade is concerned. Now, there are some signs that we might remain part of AGOA beyond this year, but nothing is guaranteed. And with global alliances shifting, protectionism rising, and elections looming in many key partner countries, what should South Africa be now doing to safeguard and even expand its ongoing trade relationships? I'm joined now by Lulu Kruchel, who's chief economist at PwC, who is applying her mind to this particular issue. So, Lulu, a very warm welcome. And how would you, first of all, describe our current standing in the global trade ecosystem? Are we well positioned, or do you think we're increasingly on the back foot?
Jeremy, I think with all the changes that are happening, realignments, etc., I must be honest, as much as I don't like saying it, I do think we are increasingly on the back foot. You mentioned, obviously, in the beginning that there's a lot of shifts that's happening. And if you look at our U.S. relationship, that's the one that we should be looking at. Then we also have to, of course, look at our relationship with Europe as a bloc. It's a very, very important trade partner for South Africa. And then, of course, with China. And I think the complexity that we have to manage at the moment between those three, as you know, some of our major, or I would say our three major trade partners, if you look at it in total, is that there's a relationship between the U.S. and China that's playing out. There's a relationship between the U.S. and Europe that's playing out. There's a relationship between us, and then a relationship with all three of those. And to be brutally honest, I'm sometimes a little bit more worried about the economic knock-on effects of that relationship with Europe and China.
You talk about the complexity of the situation, and no doubt geopolitical tensions are now spilling into trade policy. What then should this country be doing to rethink our positioning, even our diplomatic positioning, to protect our economic interests? Easier said than done, I imagine.
Yeah, I think I've heard so many times over the last couple of weeks that we need an adult in the room, you know, but sometimes if the person on the other side that you are talking to is not behaving like an adult, let's be brutally honest, that's not what President Trump is doing with anybody at the moment, it makes it very complex. And I think there's an emotional component that one cannot ignore at the moment, and then there is a factual component, and making sure that you understand the emotional aspects and that you're able to calm those emotions down where needs be, and you understand the facts, are incredibly important, not only when you speak to, let's say, a Trump or, you know, somebody else, but if you look at your customer base as a business, if you're a business in South Africa and you're thinking about navigating this. Those are two things that I think that will be the hallmark of businesses that are successful in future, is the ones that are able to look at the emotions, look at the facts, and are able to address both.
Are we worrying too much, do you think, about AGOA? It's dominating headlines, obviously, after the Trump-Ramaphosa meeting, but there is genuine uncertainty around its renewal. Is it absolutely critical to South Africa's ongoing trade strategy?
It is very important. It's more important to certain sectors than others. And I think that's the complexity at the moment. If you look at some sectors that export to the US, yes, it's a significant market. But you can say, okay, fine, if that's not available to us anymore, or if we're not competitively priced, we can look at other avenues. But the reality is that there are certain markets that's incredibly dependent on the US. And also, if you look at sectors, vehicle manufacturing is the one that comes up all the time with AGOA, and certain of our manufacturing industries where it really does play an important role. So for the whole of the economy, maybe not so much of a big deal. For certain sectors in the economy, definitely. And if you think about where we landed over the weekend, let's say that 10% tariff that is now in place remains in place. Then we're talking at about 120,000 jobs that is in question. It's not to say that it will disappear. It means that there's 120,000 jobs that are under pressure as a result of this additional 10% tariff.
And Lulu, of course, part of the problem is our exports are still heavily resource-based, but it's going to take an enormous paradigm shift towards a more value-added export strategy when it comes to, say, manufacturing or even services.
Yeah, you are 100% right. And I can almost say since I became an economist, which is years ago, actually, you know, this has been something that's been debated. How do we add value? And we just haven't seemed to be able to do that. And I think there's a dual strategy that's needed, you know, where there is that downstream industries that need the inputs that we protect and look after, as well as looking at our exports. And the problem with this type of basic, goods exports and minerals and so on, is, for example, China needs that. But if there's no demand for goods that they are exporting, they're not going to export it from us. So it immediately puts you at the mercy of another economy.
And just a final one, and perhaps looking at it more inwardly, often trade deals are designed with big companies in mind. We also surely need policy shifts that are going to make our trade regime work better for smaller and medium-sized businesses, which, after all, are said to be the backbone of this country's economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I hear a lot of small and medium-sized businesses say, it's difficult for them to get access to markets. So I know that there's a big focus to say, how do we actually set up groups of companies to make sure that we have that security of supply? So that is happening at least, but that is a massive factor. And then combined with that, of course, we always talk about finance, but I almost want to say the access to markets, if that is sorted out, the finance option should become easier. So from a trade policy perspective, I would really like to see significantly more focus to say, how do we give these smaller businesses the opportunity to actually get the voice that they need in the market? And they're not going to do that one-one. You know, it's going to be groups.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Lulu Kruchel, who is Chief Economist at PwC.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's mining sector is looking on, I think, with a degree of anxiety as government unveils proposed amendments to the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act. That's quite a mouthful. Now, these changes aim to revitalize the industry by streamlining regulations, enhancing investment appeal, and also addressing challenges such as illegal mining. That's a big problem in South Africa, as well as artisanal operations. However, concerns linger regarding the potential implications of these reforms on investment. investor confidence and operational efficiency. And I can think of no better person to turn to for some expert analysis than Peter Major, Director of Mining at Modern Corporate Solutions. He is a seasoned analyst and has been a guest on the program before. So, Peter, from your perspective, and welcome to you, do these proposed amendments effectively address the core issues deterring investment in South Africa's mining sector, or do you have a completely different view?
I think it's exactly the opposite or close, Jeremy. Maybe it's not driving investors further away. They did that about 20 years ago. They took what was a pretty good operating mineral policy and they ripped the engine out of it. And they really haven't replaced the engine yet. They nationalized the mines. They put on a requirement that all mines, existing and new mines, had to have a 30% BE component, equity component. And furthermore, they must spend 70% of all their money to keep running on BE companies. And so you've really ripped the engine out. You keep changing the tires and you think, oh, now this car is going to go faster because I've changed a couple tires. So they throw in the word investor, but that's it. Nothing they do seems to be attractive to an investor. It doesn't seem to be even designed attractive to an investor. An investor wants to make sure he recoups the money he puts in the investment. He wants to make sure he recoups the cost of capital. You know, you put $100 in, the cost of that capital is 8-12% more wherever you get it from. So no, this, from what I've seen of the new amendments, and I haven't seen them in their entirety yet, it's just bells and whistles changing on a car that still doesn't have an engine.
So, Peter, if, as you say, the engine has been ripped out, what do you see as the immediate consequences for an industry that is already on the back foot?
Well, when you've got a car without an engine and your kids, you put one person in the car and the rest of you get behind and you push it. And that's kind of what's had to happen. Now, what's been pushing this car along have been these extraordinary metal prices and the fact that a lot of these existing mines were so robust, they were constructed so well, so much capital expenditure had been done on them. You can push these cars along, but as soon as you go uphill a little bit, you won't be able to do that. Uphill means these commodity prices just start flattening out. They don't have to fall down very much. They just have to flatten out. But we have been in a 20-year super cycle that coincided with the Minerals Act. And so that was giving a false push that's not sustainable and not real, but it's allowed our mining sector to carry on the last 20 years. It's not growing. In fact, a lot of it's almost gone, like gold. Gold has gone from 600 tons a year to less than 100, from 550,000 employees to 90.
So let's look at a couple of other aspects, Peter, if we can work through them. The other one, which is interesting, is the government's classification of coal, and I quote, as a critical mineral. It is predictably raising eyebrows, and surely this is going to influence this country's position in the global shift towards renewable energy. The counter argument to that, I guess, is that at this point, given energy needs in South Africa, we simply have very little choice but to go in that direction.
Look, that is true. And that's not just for us. It's for a lot of countries. Now, most minerals are critical. You know, iron is critical. You ever try and build a skyscraper without rebar? Vanadium is critical. If you don't add vanadium to your iron, the rebar will crumble, as will the building you're putting up. And you can go down the list. In fact, theoretically, the least critical mineral would be gold, but because everybody wants it, we have to keep mining it. And it's not very environmentally friendly because you have to go so deep and you have giant fans and hoists and pumps. All minerals are critical to this country because it's our main industry. Now, coal, yeah, until we come up with a better transition, be it uranium, be it natural gas, methane, who knows, you know, is it going to be solar? But you can burn coal much, much cleaner than we've been burning it. So we can keep using it. We can do a better job mining it. But I'll tell you, we were a lot more environmentally friendly when we had a properly run Eskom and when we had large, well-capitalized coal mines that could do a better job of rehabilitation than the thousands of virtually Zama-Zama and Mafia coal mines we have now.
Well, let's talk about those Zama-Zama or Mafia coal mines. Illegal mining in South Africa, Peter Major, has been a contentious and problematic issue for some time. These amendments also aim to formalize artisanal and small-scale mining. Potential benefits or challenges that you see with this initiative?
I see a lot more challenges than benefits. If you're a small miner, why do you want to be brought into the system? Then you have to pay tax. Then you're subject to all these inspections by the DMR, and you've got to file reports, and then they're going to find out, are you a BE company or are you a non-BE Zama Zama? You know, who's the ultimate shareholder here? There are so many rules and regulations. People have no idea the thousands of regulations involved in mining, and it's just layer upon layer that keeps being added every year. Most people can't even follow the Ten Commandments. How anybody can follow a couple thousand regulations on mining, I don't know. So there's no incentive for a small miner to come in. And the world was not designed for small mining. The world was not designed for small automobile manufacturing, let alone space travel. And that is a populist image that government puts out to justify and cover up a lot of their nefarious activities. And so I don't see anything bringing a small miner in because it's only going to cost him money and headache.
Peter, just a final one, and very quickly then, what key indicators are you looking at to monitor or assess the effectiveness of these reforms? What are you keeping your eye out on?
Well, if I didn't know any better, if I didn't personally and professionally think these were insignificant or they were negative, I would look for increased new mines, increased exploration, increased development from existing mines, because investors go where they can get a return. And if you just use Zambia and the DRC for an example, once they threw out the bums and their horrible mining policy that they brought in 1970s when they nationalized the mines and put on a lot of other bad conditions, once they threw that out in the new millennium, they both received tens of billions of dollars. Every year they receive billions of dollars additionally in new investment, new mines. And their production just shows you how much that $10 billion has brought. So their infrastructure still stinks. Their administration is still very inefficient and corrupt. But just because their mining policy changed, they've received tens of billions of dollars each. So it's easy to gauge if your policy is good or bad towards investors.
Always follow the money. Peter Major, Director of Mining at Modern Corporate Solutions, thank you very much indeed for the insight. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Last week, in part one of an extended interview with former Democratic Alliance leader Tony Leon, he gave us the backroom view on the Government of National Unity, as well as his thoughts on the Ramaphosa-Trump meeting. In part two today, he'll reflect on some of the high-profile political leaders that he's dealt with, and we'll start with Nelson Mandela, who he writes about in his book Being There, Backstories from the Political Front. So, Tony Leon, let's talk about some of the political figures that you mention in the book. And let's start with Nelson Mandela. I think the words that you use, or the phrase, was more charming at a distance. Was his leadership style superficial then? If you're saying that, why praise him at all?
No, look, I was the beneficiary, or the country was, of Mandela's leadership. And since we had an enormous amount of face time together, it was almost absurd. I led a seven-person party, seven-seat party, and, you know, all this presidential, this is the most famous figure in the world, used to phone me up. I'd go down the road here to his house in Houghton for breakfast. It's very early, 6 a.m. and so on. He even offered me a seat in his cabinet. But so we had a lot of encounters, but he was a complex figure. And all I'm saying is, and that was Rick Stengel, who wrote, ghost wrote Long Walk to Freedom, who said, the closer you were to Mandela, the more aloof and standoffish he was. The further away you were, the more he wanted to draw you in. Bill Clinton, brilliant example of that as well. I think some seriously brilliant political leaders have that ability. But what really I was doing in my reappraisal, I did in the book, as you know, a reappraisal of Mandela, de Klerk, and Buthelezi, who all three have died since I last wrote about them, so more distance then. But the interesting thing about Mandela was, and Johnny Steinberg actually identified this in his book, Winnie and Nelson, were the masks he wore. So he wasn't one thing. Nelson Mandela was a deeply contradictory person. And in those contradictions, I think, came the essence of his leadership, which for the most part was excellent. But there were, of course, as with everything, certain moments where one mask slipped and another was put on. And that wasn't always known to people. And I identified and probed just two of those instances where this figure of, you know, munificence and beneficence and all those great attributes which he had and displayed so often became something else. And it wasn't always the smiling, genial Madiba.
Let's talk about F.W. de Klerk now. I think it was Colin Eglin who you quote as saying that he wasn't a great leader. What was his greatest flaw, do you think?
Well, Colin said, Colin was more ambivalent about that. He said he might not be a great man, but he certainly did a great thing. The ambivalence in de Klerk and I are fully discussed in the book, and I was on both sides, if you like, of the de Klerk ledger. So when I was a lecturer at Wits University in 1989, the same year I was elected to Parliament from Houghton, de Klerk was Minister of Education, and he introduced draconian regulations to further segregate education, called the de Klerk regulations, in South Africa, and we had protests and all this. So he was this extreme conservative, as he was understood to be, and as his whole political life hitherto had been, who then commits this extraordinary act of political apostasy by changing 350 years of settled history. And the question is, as I say in Afrikaans, vivas die ware Jacob. And I suggest that I don't know that de Klerk intended fully all the consequences of that remarkable speech, the by far the most important speech ever delivered from a platform parliament, because it literally changed the course of the country, and he had the power to execute the change, not to see them through. That was, you know, other figures and parties came in. And I came to the conclusion, well, once again, there was a contradiction. This conservative, reactionary National Party leader becomes the harbinger of the most radical change seen in South Africa hitherto. And he was probably both those things. And I had some long conversations with him afterwards when he'd retired and I'd retired. And I described some of them because I thought it was quite reflective.
Tony Leon, you've raised concern in the book about Helen Ziller's continued power within the structures of the Democratic Alliance. You don't like her, do you?
I do actually like her, and I do admire her, but I'm, and we, you know, for the most part, get on well. And I describe
several moments, yes.
Siviwe Guruba, the Minister of Education, now she said they're like an old married couple. They're always arguing. We go back a long way. I do in the book give very full ventilation to her many qualities, which are considerable. However, the other side, the ledger, Wordsworth was described as having the defect of his qualities, is that I think the fundamental issue, which I do highlight, is that it's a bit like a business where you have a long-serving, much-admired CEO. The CEO retires, a new CEO is appointed, and then lo and behold, the former CEO comes back not as a CEO, but as the chief operating officer. So I think there's a bit of an awkward fit between the new CEO, who's, well, not new, he's been there for 6 years, John Steenhuisen, and the former leader, CEO, coming back as the number two in the party. And Helen has a very outsized personality, which often serves her causes with distinction, but it tends to rather overwhelm the space in which the leader should be getting the spotlight. I raised that because a lot of people raised it with me, and it was my own observation. On the other hand, and I need to say this, Helen did not say, I demand to be the federal chairman or chairman of the federal executive. She was elected by 70% of the delegates at the last conference. So she is a popular choice in the party. They're having a conference next year. I guess they'll look at their leadership and refresh it or not.
Would the party be better off without her?
Well, I think she adds, and I make this point in the book, a lot of rigor to the management of the party. But I think, you know, Helen's 7 years older than me, and I left politics before she left. I think all leaderships anywhere, Jeremy, not just confined to politics, need to be refreshed. That's my view.
So let me ask you one last question about the future of the Democratic Alliance, a party that you served in for a long time. A lot of suggestion might be that it keeps trying to be all things to all voters, liberal for business, populist for working class whites, technocratic for the suburbs. Is there an identity crisis?
Well, I think it's whether it's a crisis or the challenge of being a what you might call a broad church party. I mean, although it's only got 22% of the vote, it's by far and away, but by multiples, the largest opposition force in this country. There's no one comes close. I mean, well, Zuma's party, but Zuma's very, very mono-ethnic and largely, not entirely, confined to one suburb with some support on the Witwatersrand and Mpumalanga. The DA is a national party. It's got reach in all provinces. It's the majority. It's a party of choice for all racial minorities here, perhaps being challenged among coloureds by Gayton McKenzie, but still the number one choice. And it has some footprint, the eternal quest, as you know, among black African voters, but it, according to the latest polls, it's growing precisely because it's in government. So you've got to try and represent all those different interests. And sometimes you get it right and sometimes you get it wrong. I don't think the DA should be cultish. I don't think it should be, you know, a pure liberal party. But I think it does need to remind itself, never mind the voters and the government, of why it's in business. Why are you in politics? And I make some suggestions in my book. And my book ends with a look at the career of my colleague who died very young, or relatively young, Dean Smuts, you know, who really stood up for in a very effective way for a stringent set of causes and principles. And if you lose that, you've lost everything. Now, I'm not saying the DA has lost it, but they need to kind of, you know, often repurpose why they're in politics.
Tony Leon, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, in a world flooded with content and often overwhelmed by choice, the old school hard sell is losing its grip, I think it's fair to say. Consumers these days want facts. They don't necessarily want flash. They need guidance and not gimmicks. Now, there's some new research out, and it says around 83% of people are more likely to buy from brands that offer deeper, more meaningful and useful information. In that respect, I'm going to talk now to Michael Gullen, who's Chief Executive Officer, G&G Advocacy, and a leader in educational marketing. And I want him to explain why brands that educate are outpacing those that simply persuade, and how smart sales teams are becoming trusted advisors and not just deal closers. So, Michael, a very warm welcome. And what then, in your opinion, is the biggest reason that the so-called hard sell no longer works in today's market?
I think it's because consumers have information at their fingertips. Firstly, we have Google, and now we have chat and AI. And so we're able to access information about a product, extensive information online quickly. And more we're looking for information that educates us, that helps us to understand the benefits of the product or service we're looking for and helps us make an informed decision. What we're not looking for is that barrage of marketing information. So we move from wanting to be convinced or sold to being informed and reassured.
So I understand that, more information and not necessarily being convinced, but what does that really look like in practice?
So what it looks like in practice mostly is that educational marketing is aimed at a company's sales channel, as it were, because that's always the first point of contact that a consumer is going to have with the company. And where a sales channel is informed about how to talk to the benefits of a product and or a service rather than the hard sell mechanics of selling it, they're able to share information from a place of understanding the consumer's need and the application of that product or service in the context of why they're purchasing it. And so they're talking to solving a problem rather than selling a problem. And that sales process, that information and understanding of the need state, helps the consumer to feel confident about the decision they're making rather than seeing through some hard sell sales approach.
So let me put my cynic's hat on. This concept, yes, or this term educational marketing, Michael, come on, it's just a fancy term for training, isn't it? Or is it more of a strategic sales tool?
Now, Jeremy, I think those two worlds merge very well. And I think the cynical hat that you wear right there is spot on. I mean, if I were to give you an example in the pharmacy industry, you know, pharmacists or medical professionals, one of the most valuable commodities that they have is time. And to ask a medical professional, any other professional, to give up their time to engage with learning material as opposed to making a sale or dealing with a customer or patient is a big ask. But they'll willingly give up time to engage with learning content, educational content, as you've just said, if it creates value for them. And if that's provided by a company, there becomes a link of trust and brand advocacy built into that.
So what's the difference then between content marketing and educational marketing?
So content marketing primarily is generated via search and inbound leads, generally articles written specifically around a particular topic. Educational marketing is information built in bite-sized chunks, particularly if it's in an e-learning, online learning environment, bite-sized sort of 5 or 10 minute micro-learning moments to land a learning moment or an aha moment that's of value to a professional or someone that would work with that information in the course of what they do. And that builds the confidence to integrate and apply that knowledge and in the context of that, recommend or sell a product that that the company is providing the training or the information, the educational marketing for.
Michael, is there a way to measure the ROI of education versus the traditional approach?
Absolutely, Jeremy. I think that's the core of it, and that's what excites us the most about it, is integrated into educational marketing is the ability to create exposure to products and those sorts of things. And then the back end of that is to actually measure within the sales channel the sales impact on sales professionals who are exposed to the education marketing versus those that aren't. And we see some really meaningful ROI and performance stats in the market that are really sort of informing the decisions and the positive moves around educational marketing. So it's extremely measurable.
So in practical terms then, or pushing on from that, how do companies now need to rethink their sales and referral team strategy in light of the model that you're espousing?
So, Jeremy, firstly, it's an add-on rather than a replacement. I think that as we live in a more digitally fragmented or information fragmented marketplace, one doesn't replace the other. And so a good example of this would be a company that's looking to extend its reach amongst its sales channels and wants to create a combination of confidence in a product or service and in additional information. So again, using the pharmacy industry, many companies can't have reps out in the marketplace seeing all pharmacists. But if they create meaningful educational marketing and courses, those pharmacists or pharmacy assistants go online and engage with content so they get that scale of reach and frequency in a cost-effective way.
The difficulty, of course, is that we live in a fast-moving digital world, and it's difficult, surely, to keep educational marketing content both current and I guess, credible.
Ah, Jeremy, you go to the very core of it. And that's why it becomes a long-term strategic investment from companies, because to that very point, it requires a consistent review and analysis of the content that performs and a willingness to continually, sort of every two years, update that content to ensure it's relevant and it's fresh for the market. Absolutely.
I'm going to leave it there. Michael Gullen, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, G&G Advocacy. I appreciate your time. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.